folks, and welcome to The Blender, the new weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. This is Grant Podolko, an editor at rferl.org, and I'll be your host this week. On this week's show, we talk to Luke Allnut, the editor-in-chief of rferl.org, and the man behind the tech blog known as Tangled Web.
I'm basically looking at the smart ways in which people are using digital tools for activism, but I'm also looking at how repressive governments are using the same tools or developing their tools to crack down on activism.
Mohammed Amin Mudakik of Radio Free Afghanistan talks about being a young man in Afghanistan in the early 1980s and his narrow escape from the clutches of occupying Soviet soldiers.
The Russians suddenly came, followed me up to the house and suddenly encircled the house. I had minutes to hide myself. There was no chance of escape.
And correspondent Ron Sinovitz explores the culture, history, and techniques surrounding the ancient Kyrgyz instrument known as the komuz. But first to Russia, where a story bubbled up this week that even casual Kremlin watchers like me found fascinating. On March 22nd, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin sharply criticized the UN-mandated mission to enforce a no-fly zone over Libya to protect civilians and the subsequent bombing campaign by coalition forces to remove Tripoli's air defenses. Russia abstained from the UN vote, which allowed the resolution to pass. Let's listen to what Putin had to say about the UN resolution.
It actually resembles medieval calls for crusades, when someone called on others to go on a certain place and liberate it.
A short time later, President Dmitry Medvedev appeared to put Putin in his place with a strongly worded rebuttal of his own. Medvedev said it was his wish that Russia not block the resolution and called Putin's remarks unacceptable.
Ни в коем случае недопустимо использовать выражения.
Under no circumstances is it acceptable to use expressions that essentially lead to a clash of civilizations, such as crusades and so on. It is unacceptable. Otherwise, everything may end up much worse than what's going on now. Everyone should remember that.
Ouch! Or at least that's the word my guest here in the studio used to describe this exchange in a blog post this week. Brian Whitmore is the editor of the Europe Desk in our central newsroom, the author of the Power Vertical blog, and the host of the Power Vertical podcast. Thanks for coming in, Brian.
Thanks, Grant.
So what the heck is going on here?
Well, this is the funny thing here, Grant, is that we often see these what look like fake conflicts between Putin and Medvedev. And it's really easy to dismiss this at first because we've seen this many times before, Medvedev and Putin playing what looks like a good cop, bad cop routine.
Right.
This time, it looked very, very different. Not just the harshness of the rhetoric from both the prime minister and the president, but also the context that was around this. Just hours before the United Nations began debating the resolution 1973, Medvedev dismissed Russia's ambassador to Libya, Vladimir Chamov, who was very visibly pro-regime in Libya, was opposed to the no-fly zone vocally. And if you can believe what's being written in the Russian press, had a lot of ties to business deals that Russian interests were conducting in Libya. So therefore, they had a lot to lose in a conflict situation. And he was fired unceremoniously. He just returned to Moscow today. So if you take that first thing into account, it shows that something real is going on here. There is a real division over foreign affairs in Russia right now. Part of the elite centered around Medvedev, favors kind of dialing back the conflict with the West, so to speak. There was a report issued by the foreign ministry last spring that recommended this to dial back the conflict with the West in order to get more investment for modernization and so on and so forth. The Siloviki, the security service veterans surrounding Putin, on the other hand, are not really in favor of this. There is a genuine philosophical conflict, and this philosophical conflict kind of bubbled up in the situation around Libya. It's very real. I don't know how consequential it's going to be, because it's no news to anybody that watches Russia that there are differences in the elite. And sometimes these differences are attributed to Putin and Medvedev. I think Putin and Medvedev are really more on the same page than people think they are. They kind of need each other. They both represent different parts of society, different parts of the elite, but the elite very much wants to keep these two orientations together. So I don't know how consequential this is, but this is just a rare glimpse, public glimpse, between the two most powerful people in the country of a debate about foreign policy that's been bubbling below the surface for a long time.
And what was Putin's reaction to the president's
This is what's interesting. I mean, Putin backed right. The first interesting thing I saw was that the Russian television, which is something you really have to pay attention to kind of read the tea leaves in Russia, they removed Putin's comments in the later news broadcasts and replaced them with Medvedev. Mm-hmm. And you had Medvedev standing there looking very much the tough guy with his leather bomber jacket on, commander-in-chief jacket, making those comments that we just heard, calling Putin's remarks unacceptable. That was very telling. When television does something like that, nothing happens by accident on television in Russia. That was telling. Soon after that, Putin said he was that the president speaks for Russia, and he was just expressing his private opinion. Now, whether a prime minister can publicly express his private opinion in a public forum is another matter entirely. But it was interesting to see Putin kind of back off on this.
And from what we know about Putin, that's quite something to see him sort of back off that way.
Well, Putin's like a cat. I mean, he'll back off and then he'll attack you when you least expect it. So I'm not. I don't think, as I wrote in the blog, this could be a smokescreen. You always have to be careful writing about these things, Grant, because it's like in Russia there are so many layers of subterfuge. There's even a special word in the Russian language for this called pokazuka,
right.
Which means just for show. So you really have to be careful with this. And I tried to hedge it a little bit in the blog the way I wrote it. But it seems to me something different's going on here. And this doesn't appear to be completely over yet. Like I said, this Ambassador Chamov, or former Ambassador Chamov, returned to Moscow today. So we can expect to see a little bit more fallout from this incident.
Well, as I said, even for a casual Kremlin watcher like me, this did seem to sort of rise above the usual level of rhetoric. So I guess, as they say, time will tell. And thanks, Brian, for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Grant.
Yow, yow. Yow, yow. Yow, yow. Yow.
Mohammed Amid Mudakik is the senior editor of RFERL's Radio Free Afghanistan. To kick off a new podcast segment we're calling This Is My Story, Amin recounts in his own words the harrowing day in 1981 when he outwitted occupying Soviet soldiers in their efforts to recruit him into the military.
My name is Mohammed Amin Mudakik. I'm the senior editor of the Afghan Service of Radio Free Europe, or Radio Azadi in Prague. I'll tell you a story about when the former Soviet Union occupied Afghanistan. People were not ready to go to serve in the military. In Afghanistan, just before the fall of the Taliban, the military service was compulsory. Every person above the age of 18 up to 35 has to serve 2 years in the Afghan military. But because the Afghans hate the occupation of their country by the former Soviet Union, they were refusing to go to the military service. So, but in some area, the area was flat, people cannot flee much, and in the mountainous area, they were able to go up to the mountain and hide, but in the flat area, they had no option but to hide, to make a kind of hideout for themselves. Some of them were very interesting. Like the one I had was in a stream of water above the, of which there was a wall. So what I was doing, I was entering the stream, and then the part of the wall which was passing on the stream was digged and made a hole of 1 meter on each flank. Then the bunch of wood was put on that hole. So when I was going among the water, one advantage was that my footprint was washed away by the water. And then when the soldiers were coming to the point, they were thinking that it is just a wall above the stream, which crossed the stream. So I was hiding there every time when the Soviets were coming to my village, In one particular day, it was something like 2 to 2:30, between 2 and 2:30 in the afternoon, that the Russians suddenly came, followed me up to the house, and suddenly encircled the house. So I had minutes to hide myself. There was no chance of escape. So I went to the hiding, and I covered myself properly. They came and searched all the houses, but find no clue. Then they warned my family, saying that we have to find him. Otherwise, they will stay there overnight, next day, and demolish the house room by room until they find me. So, but my family didn't know where my hideout is. Suddenly, a grape seller went out of the village, was allowed, who was not belonging to that village. Then my elder brother, who was with the other resistance group outside, asked this grape seller what was going on in his village. He said that your house was encircled. Even the grape seller did not know that I am in this. Then my brother realized that, my Mujahideen or my fighter brother is at house, so he must be at risk. But he knew that I have a good hideout. So he immediately took 5 other fighters with him, and he rushed to the siege. He also did not have a good chance, but a miracle again helped him, because by the time he rushed to the village, 3 hours was already passed from the search. So the Russians were searching me for 3 consecutive hours, finding no clue, beating my brothers, my sister, my old father, but getting nothing. And finally, when my brother reached, the miracle was that at that time, the Russians and their spies were out of their armored personal carrier. They were on the ground, sitting under the shadow of a tree and playing cards. So they were completely surprised by this small group of commando, including my brother. They were showered by bullets, and then they had forced to leave their APC and flee to another direction, because if they were supposed to climb the APC, they were all would be eliminated. But still, they lost one of the Russian soldiers, but the APC was left abandoned. My brother immediately took action, removed the heavy machine guns of the APC, and put the APC on fire. When the blame rose, then higher command said that, did you get the target? They said no. They said, without target, the APC is on fire. Come back. It's a failed mission. So they abandoned a plan of staying at night and demolishing the house and searching me room by room. And then they left the siege. And again, my life was saved, and that's why I'm here.
That was Mohammad Amin Mudakik of Radio Free Afghanistan.
You're listening to The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's new weekly podcast.
Janil Chetrabayeva is a broadcaster with our Kyrgyz service and an aficionado of the Central Asian stringed instrument known as the komuz. For the latest installment of a segment we call A Different Beat, correspondent Ron Sinovitz invited Janil into our Prague studios to discuss the history of, and to play, the komuz.
Welcome to A Different Beat. We're here with Janil Chetrabayeva, who has brought a komuz from Kyrgyzstan.
Hello.
This is an interesting instrument that you've brought to share with us. It looks rather like a guitar, although there are no frets on the neck, and there are only 3 strings, but it has a wooden face on the body. I'm assuming that it's a hollow resonating chamber inside, but there's only a small pinhole where a resonating hole would be for the guitar.
Some people say, yes, Kyrgyz guitar, but it's actually called komuz, and it's very traditional instrument you probably find in every other household. It is made of apricot. Usually it's all made from materials from the nature.
These are brown silk thread strings. They look rather like they're wound, the way that a metal string would be on a Western guitar. However, the material is completely made of silk. Is that correct?
Sometimes they use for the strings fishing lines, but I don't think it sounds well. They used to use goat's guts. They would dry it and prepare it, but if you play it every day for some hours, that would last probably only a few days or a week. So it's not practical and it's abandoned. Now they use the silk strings.
There is a bridge on the wooden face of the body. Does that bridge move at all or is it permanently attached?
No, it is separate. We make it wet and we fix it there each time. It's not attached.
So it's a floating bridge on the face of the body.
But it has to be fixed during the performance.
It's on the neck. It's completely fretless.
No, I understand it's also apricot and there are no frets. When I started learning to play this instrument, I had no idea that there could be frets. But the teacher or stud would make a mark with a pencil and say that, okay, you keep it your one finger there.
The three tuning pegs, they're made of wood and they're slotted into wooden holes. Now, with a wood-on-wood tuning peg, one might use chalk in order to give a grip. But I've seen that you've actually spit on the wooden tuning peg. Is that to give it a grip or is that to make it more flexible so you can tune the note?
To make it more movable, because when I move it, sometimes it's stuck and then I have to spit. And this is normal way of doing it. We do it all the time, of course, not in front of audience during a concert, obviously. And you can fix the note and then press a bit that it keeps it there. I never saw anyone using chalk, probably. I should try once.
Why don't you play a little piece of music for us that comes from Kyrgyzstan, something that's traditional music?
Very traditional. We have different type of music. Some of them are light and for children or for just entertainment or for foreigners, if you like. But on the other hand, they also have so-called heavy philosophical music melodies. So they usually have also small stories to tell. For example, Karuzgoy, I will play a small part of it. There are a couple of interpretations, but I stick to one where it says that this is a story of clan wars where the nomads tribes, they would sometimes attack each other. They would have some quarrels, but then there were peace times and there were celebrations. So Karuzgoy is said to be about that.
While you're playing this piece and I'm watching what you're doing, your right hand is doing a downstroke sometimes, but your right hand, a finger, is hitting the face of the instrument, rather like a percussion sound. Meanwhile, your left hand is fingering the neck of the instrument, much like a guitarist would. You're not really bending your thumb over, for example, the top and playing, so you're playing the three strings as melody strings. But what also strikes the listener is that the rhythmical pattern that you're playing has very much a rather rhythmic-like of a horse running or a horse galloping.
Yeah, this is the main difference between the nomadic, so-called nomadic or Turkic Mongolian music, if you like. The instruments and music of these people, they resonate the music of the nature and flowing water. Sometimes you gallop, sometimes you go slowly on a horse, and so it always changes.
What is very striking is that your right hand, which is strumming the strings, is also performing, one could say it's a visual ballet. The hand is almost doing a classical dance and motions that you're going through. Is this part of the tradition of this instrument?
We Kyrgyz have no dance. And for me, playing komuz is like dancing. It's a dance of a hand. We have it as a part of our traditional music, that some melodies are basically about hand dance.
I want to thank you for coming here, Janil Chetarbayeva, and sharing with us the Komuz from Kyrgyzstan. Would you like to play one more piece of music for us before we go?
Sure.
Watch a video of Janil performing a song on the Komuz, including, as Ron mentioned, the extraordinary visual ballet that goes into each song, visit the Blender blog at referl.org.
З вами Радио Свобода.
Совместная программа Центральноазиатских
служб.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
The tech blog known as Tangled Web is a relatively new addition to RFERL.org, and one that proved to be immediately popular. Posts from Tangled Web are often some of the most read items on our website. The motto of Tangled Web is Digital Dissidents and Digital Rogues, and to find out what that means, we've invited Luke Allnut into the studio. Luke's the guy behind Tangled Web, and also the editor-in-chief of RFERL.org. Welcome to the Blender, Luke.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about your blog. What's the concept behind it?
Well, I'm basically looking at the smart ways in which people are using digital tools for activism. But I'm also looking at how repressive governments are using the same tools or developing their tools to crack down on activism. So I'm interested, for example, in how activists are using Facebook and viral video. For instance, as we saw recently in Egypt and Azerbaijan. But also the way that countries like Iran, Russia, China are using internet tools to control discourse and especially social media.
Can you give us an example of something recently that's been in the news that sort of illustrates what you're writing about?
Well, I think recently it's been very interesting with the uprisings in the Arab world to see what role social media has played. And the discussion about the importance of social media started with the so-called Twitter revolution in Iran in 2009, but then the role of that was seen as somehow diminished and somehow less. There was a big Malcolm Gladwell article earlier, it was last year, where he talked about, diminished the role of social media in these things, because he advanced this argument that the ties that social media enables are too weak to actually lead to effective protest movements. But then with the Arab uprisings and especially the role of Facebook in Tunisia and especially Egypt, we have seen that they have played a big role. The flip side to that, of course, is that actually governments like the Egyptian governments and in particular the Tunisian governments also used Facebook to clamp down on dissidents and infiltrate opposition activists. So it really is a situation where social media brings lots of benefits, but it also there's lots of negative qualities as well.
Can you talk a little bit about one of your most recent posts, this idea of a wiki witness? And I know that blog post generated a lot of comments on our website.
Sure. It's basically that these uprisings in the Arab world have generated huge amounts of user-generated content. So all these videos, like, for instance, the famous Neda video in Iran, are hugely important for getting the message out and for showing the outside world how dictatorships are brutal. But this information is hugely important for the historical record. But also, I think that information, those videos, those photos, that user-generated content also could be useful if ever, for instance, in Egypt, secret police officers or army personnel are held accountable for what they've done. The problem at the moment is that a lot of that information, those videos, those photos, are held by intermediaries. So, for instance, they're in the hands of YouTube or Flickr. The problem with that, often those companies take down that information, not because they're against that particular information, but because often they're flagged for abuse or a critical mass of people flag them for abuse, which means they're taken down. So the idea of something like WikiWitness would mean that you would have an organization that worked through a popular platform like YouTube and was linked to something with serious credentials like the UN. And it would be a secure, safe platform that enables people to remain anonymous, where the terabytes of videos, photos, or other raw data could be archived for use in an investigation or simply to preserve history. That's the basic idea.
Have you always been interested in these sort of tech topics? I mean, did you start the blog because you saw a gap in the sort of the blogosphere for this kind of coverage?
Yeah. I've always been interested in web and technology in general. Although in recent years, I've been a lot more interested in the relationship between the internet and democratization. I was especially influenced by the work of Yevgeny Morozov, who has written an excellent book called The Net Delusion recently about the dark side of the internet. I mean, I think he often gets unfairly characterized as a cyber skeptic or a pessimist, but actually I think he's much more realistic about the possibilities of technology. And as I mentioned earlier, technology and the internet brings huge benefits, but there's also limitations as well. I mean, you saw great movement. Facebook has enabled these huge leaderless mass movements, the type of which we saw in Colombia or Egypt. But again, it's also a handy tool for repressive governments to follow and crack down on democracy movements.
Well, thanks for being on The Blender, Luke.
You're welcome.
And you can find Tangled Web, along with all of our other blogs, on our website at rferl.org. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for turning on The Blender.
I think I'm going to push the smoothie button.
Got a question or a suggestion for The Blender? We'd love to hear from you. Write to podcast@rferl.org. Until next week, this is Grant Podolko. Take care, everybody.